This is 9/11 Freefall.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. We have an important episode tonight. This is going to be an update regarding the grand jury petition. Mick Harrison and Dave Meiswinkle of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry are here to talk about that. I'll be bringing that to you in just a moment.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Today, I am joined by two representatives of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. First one is Mick Harrison. He's the Director of Litigation for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. He's a public interest attorney who graduated summa cum laude from the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. He has a national practice focused on cases that involve whistleblower protection, government accountability, corporate fraud and false claims, and dangers to public health or the environment. Over the last 25 years, he has worked in partnering on such cases with the Government Accountability Project, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the Chemical Weapons Working Group, the National Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and the Vietnam Veterans Organizations, among others. A lot of great experience there. He's joined by David Meiswinkle, who's the president of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. He is a criminal defense attorney, a retired police officer of 23 years, a reporter, a former U.S. Army veteran, and he was a candidate for governor in New Jersey in 2009. He holds a Bachelor of Arts from Rutgers College, an M.A. from New York University, and a J.D. from Seton Hall University Law School. So these guys, again, have a lot of experience behind them, and they got a lot to talk about regarding the petition filed to the grand jury that we brought them here on the show. I think it was in December to talk about. We get a lot of questions asking for updates on this thing. Well, you're getting one today, and it is a big one. So first, guys, I wanted to say welcome back to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Andy.
So I always think I'm picking up new listeners and people who may have just woken up to 9/11 truth issues last week and are trying to catch up to nearly 18 years of news and knowledge when they hear this show, perhaps. So in case there's members of the audience who are somehow unaware of the background to today's topic, Mick, can you first briefly remind our audience of the action taken by the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry last December regarding the grand jury?
Well, our grand jury work has proceeded in several steps, Andy, and I think we actually initiated it in July, and then that was filing a petition to the U.S. Attorney in New York. And the focus, as you know, and some of your readers may not know yet, was to present the evidence of use of explosives and incendiaries, controlled demolition, at the World Trade Center on 9/11 to bring down three buildings, the two towers and Building 7. And we provided extensive scientific evidence, much of which had been developed and or articulated by architects and engineers and other independent scientists. And we have about a 50-page petition that explains the law as well as the scientific evidence, the law relating to grand juries. And we also attached a lot of that evidence in various forms, including testimony videotaped in New York in 2016 from a lot of the architects, engineers, and scientists. So after presenting that somewhat voluminous initial filing, we amended it, and Dave may have to remind me. We may have filed the initial one in April and amended it in July.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, thank you for getting the months mixed up. So the amendment articulated some additional federal crimes that we are requesting be investigated by a federal special grand jury and the U.S. attorney, still all related to the use of explosives and incendiaries on 9/11 at the World Trade Center. We then filed a supplement after that, and that supplement focused on, trying to think of a tactful way to say this, persons who may have material information regarding those crimes on 9/11 at the World Trade Center, not necessarily folks who are suspects, but folks who have are in a position to know key information that may be useful to their special grand jury in investigating these crimes. And that was another detailed filing. And then we did, Dave Meisselnickel and I communicated with the U.S. attorney after that, and we were seeking confirmation of our filing and that there would be action on our petition as the law requires. And I think I may stop there and let Dave fill in about what communications we did receive, first in a letter and then follow up by telephone with the U.S. attorney's office. Dave, do you want to update on that?
All right. On November 7, 2018, the Lawyers Committee received a letter from Michael Ferreira, who is the Chief of Terrorism and International Narcotics in the Southern District of Manhattan, New York. And he wrote on behalf of Jeffrey Berman, who is the United States Attorney. And he said in the letter, "We have received and reviewed the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry submissions of April 10th and July 30th, 2018. We will comply with the provisions of 18 U.S.C. 3332 as they relate to your submissions." So this is a follow-up to that letter, Andy. And we actually called the office of the Chief of Terrorism, Michael Ferreira. And we spoke to another person in the office briefly and told them that we wanted to talk to Michael Ferreira. And within a short period of time, he answered the phone, and he was very respectful, and we told him that we wanted some kind of confirmation concerning the letter we sent him, and he certainly confirmed it. He actually referred to the letter that he had signed and sent to us, and we inquired as to if he could give us any information regarding this happening, the grand jury, and he basically said that because it's a secret procedure, and I believe he quoted Federal Rule 6E, having to do with secrecy, that he could not. Now, he did not say that the grand jury was not convened in reviewing evidence, which is, I think, a very good thing. He didn't say it wasn't. He just said he couldn't comment on it because of the secrecy. So this letter was, as we like to say, it gave us credibility. It allowed us to basically enter the castle, and that's the way I describe it. We are inside the castle now, and we were trying to get some kind of representation that the U.S. attorney is acting in good faith, and the exhibits, which were 57 exhibits, and the petition, which is 52 pages, that in fact that is being reviewed by the U.S. attorney and the grand jury, and they are conducting a criminal investigation. That was the purpose of our call. Now, there's different ways to interpret that, and maybe Mick would like to start off as far as what the interpretation is when the chief of terrorism basically says it's a secret procedure and he can't comment any further. Is that a good thing, bad thing, neutral thing? We have our way. We look at that. But, Nick, why don't you take it from there?
Okay. Well, that's sort of the question of the day, how to read the secrecy procedure. Rule 6E does very explicitly prohibit a U.S. attorney from disclosing to anyone, which would include us, proceedings that are happening before a special grand jury, but it does not, in my reading, preclude a U.S. attorney from telling someone that something in particular, like our petition, was not presented to a special grand jury. So in other words, even though the U.S. attorney's hands may well be tied by Rule 6E in telling us details of what's going on before the grand jury, if they're acting on our petition, as we expect and hope, I don't believe it would have prevented the U.S. attorney or Mr. Ferrara from telling us that there was nothing that was presented to the special grand jury. So to me, the most probable reading of Mr. Ferrara's very professional call with us was that he was simply trying to follow the law and that they were proceeding to, you know, present our petition and the evidence to the special grand jury as the law requires and as we requested, but he simply couldn't tell us the details of that. Now, we don't know that for certain, which is our predicament, and we do have, you know, our nonprofit mission that we're, you know, very dedicated to, which is to promote transparency and accountability regarding 9/11. We have a number of folks who have signed this petition with us, more than 2,000, and I'm sure it would be many more had we continued to actively request more signatures. So there's of course a much greater audience in the 9/11 Truth Movement who really would like this petition to be acted on and would like to know its status. So we feel an ethical obligation to follow up. So the question then is, you know, how do we proceed? And we do have some options, and I guess I'll wait for a question from you, Andy or Dave, to explain, you know, the options of where we go from here.
There was a press release, or I don't know if it's actually a press release, it was more of a bulletin to our supporters of your group and our group that was just released on July 1st. It says, Lawyers Committee to file mandamus petition as U.S. Attorney declines to disclose status of 9/11 grand jury proceeding. And I think this has made our supporters very happy. Maybe not the fact you're not getting that simple information that you want, but that you guys are so vigilantly staying on top of this and not letting this get slid under the rug or forgotten about in our system. But can you talk about that action?
The mandamus action is an action to compel a government official to do what they're legally obligated to do. In this case, the U.S. attorney is obligated to present the evidence we presented to him to a special grand jury. Now, what he said in that letter, he said that basically he's reviewed the material, but he received it, he reviewed it, and he will comply with the statute, which I just mentioned, that's part of what the statute says. So the trickiness, at least the way I look at it, when you file the mandamus, you're asking the judge to order the U.S. attorney to do his job, right, to make a presentation. And he's telling us, basically, he's doing that, all right? So we don't know if he's doing it or not. We assume that he's doing it, and maybe, as Nick read Mr. Ferrara told us, the chief of terrorism, is that he can't comment on it, which is different than saying, no, we're not doing it, all right? Which leads you to believe that they are doing something. But so we have different options here. In reference, just to compare it with the FBI lawsuit, there's an FBI lawsuit down in Washington where there's a mandamus involved also, and where we're asking the FBI to do certain things. They're supposed to assess information that wasn't previously considered by the original 9/11 commission. Well, here we're asking the judge, through a mandamus action, that's what it would do, would ask the judge to basically instruct the U.S. attorney to do his job. The thing is, he may be doing his job, all right? He may be doing it right now. So Mick has thought of an idea that maybe could be utilized to, just to not soften it, but to proceed perhaps the mandamus, which we're still considering. That's the logical follow-up. Mick, why don't you, if you feel it's proper, to disclose that strategy. I'm not sure if we should disclose it here, but, you know, I'll leave that up to you. But we do have a strategy of how to do that, possibly.
Right. So I don't think the strategy is particularly sensitive or confidential. It's almost a common sense strategy that would be, I think, predicted by the U.S. attorney. And at the moment, although in litigation normally you consider the defendant an adversary, usually in more ways than one, that is not necessarily the case here. As Dave mentions, we're in the unusual position here of contemplating a mandamus lawsuit, and your listeners may not realize that the only purpose, the only legal purpose of a mandamus lawsuit is to force an agency official to comply with a mandatory duty that there is evidence to indicate they are not complying with. And that's the congressionally created purpose of the mandamus statute. Now here, the U.S. attorney has communicated in writing to us that the U.S. attorney is complying. And our telephone conversation did not give us any reason to believe otherwise, other than we didn't get explicit confirmation of the details. So we're in an awkward position of trying to go to the federal court and ask a judge to order compliance when, in fact, compliance may be occurring. So the alternative strategy that Dave mentions that we've developed, which is also, in my view, contemplated under Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, is to ask first the federal court to order a disclosure. The disclosure would be a limited disclosure of the status of the grand jury proceedings regarding our petition relating to the World Trade Center on 9/11 and the demolition evidence, and the court would have the authority and discretion to determine how much would be disclosed, to whom it would be disclosed, and in what manner it would be disclosed. But the goal of asking for a disclosure first, before we got to the actual mandamus request, which would be for an order compelling compliance with the statute, the goal of the disclosure would be to let us know where we stand. Do we have compliance or do we have noncompliance? And if the judge can do a proper order to disclose just enough information so we know the answer to that question, it would not interfere with the grand jury's investigation. It would not interfere with the U.S. attorney's work. It's not like this is a major secret that potential, perpetrators wouldn't know. There's certainly been, a high profile about the whole grand jury petition. So a limited disclosure in this case would not be counterproductive to the purpose of a full investigation, but would allow us to know whether we needed to proceed with a mandamus request or not. So the filing we're contemplating now, Andy, is a two-part filing. The first part would be a request for a disclosure of the status of our grand jury petition with appropriate limitations to be set by the federal court. And the second, still present, the backup, would be if for some reason the judge determines that no disclosure can be made, and I don't believe that's what the law would say, but the judge might decide that, if we can't get any disclosure, or if the judge in fact orders a disclosure of the status, and the status is that contrary to our expectations, the U.S. attorney has not presented our petition and our evidence to the special grand jury, then we would know that there was noncompliance. At that point, our mandamus petition would be, as we say, legally ripe, meaning ready to be pursued, and we would have a factual basis for it because we would have affirmative evidence that there was noncompliance with the special grand jury statute. At that point, we could then seek the order from the federal court compelling the U.S. attorney to do what the statute requires, which is to report to the special grand jury the federal crimes and evidence thereof presented by the reporting citizens, which would be all of us who have contributed to these petitions and supplements. So that is the strategy we're currently contemplating, and we expect to be pursuing that prior to or around this anniversary of September 11th.
So the first thing I want to ask, I want to reiterate first what you said. This proposed mandamus action is a lawsuit used to compel someone, such as an officer or employee of the U.S. government, to act on an administrative matter that is not discretionary when they have legal duty to do so and have not. So this is being contemplated right now. Now, none of us are new to the truth movement here, and most of this audience probably isn't either. We know the obstacles that we have faced. At the same time, I don't want to be like the corporate media. I don't want to make something out of nothing and get everyone all stirred up. If this is a normal part of everyday work for you guys and doing what you do. So I want to ask this, how normal is this circumstance from your experience where you have to consider such action just to know if the grand jury petition is moving forward, if they're even presenting it? Does this happen often with other cases?
Well, I'll start and Dave can comment as he chooses. I would say, no, it's not normal in the sense of being statistically frequent. It may be somewhat normal based on the structure of the law, however. And so these, you know, you don't get, thankfully, tragic crimes like 9/11 happening that often, more often than we might like these days, but not that often. And you don't have citizens acting on their rights to report crimes to a U.S. attorney that often. And maybe with this petition and people's increased awareness of the option, maybe that will happen more in the future, and I think that would be in the public interest. But so statistically, people don't find themselves in our position very often. Further, even in those cases where a crime has been reported to a U.S. attorney, it's not that common that you get a letter from a U.S. attorney assuring that there will be compliance, but no further details. For example, one option that has been used in the past has been that, you know, the person reporting the crime, although not in our situation, can often be a firsthand eyewitness to the crime itself, and they can be called in to testify to the grand jury directly, and normally eyewitnesses would be called in. We have seen no indication of that happening yet on our petition, but, you know, if we were to be called in, or if some of the architects and engineers were to be called in to testify, we would have indirectly found out the status that there was something, you know, actually actively going on in good faith before the grand jury, and that would sort of moot our concern. But that has not happened. So we are in an unusual and somewhat rare situation of having, you know, this horrible crime, having it reported by us to the U.S. attorney, having a written assurance of compliance, having a verbal discussion that doesn't deny compliance, but having no specific affirmative evidence of compliance. And, you know, that is a bit of an unusual and challenging legal circumstance. Dave, right. Do you want to comment further?
Yeah, sure. I've had an experience, Andy, when I was a police officer with the U.S. attorney and with the FBI, and I was aware that there was an investigation, a grand jury investigation, but I wasn't aware of any of the particulars. And it was very secret, but there was an awareness, though, that it was happening. And when it did happen, and when indictments came down, because of the sensitive nature of the indictments, and at the time there was elections happening, big elections in New Jersey, the indictments were secret. So they weren't announced until after the election because they didn't want to, the FBI told me later, they didn't want to compromise it politically in any way. But as Mick said, this is it's somewhat unusual for us to be in the situation. Most of the time you're in this situation. And second is to try to give the benefit of the doubt to the United States government that they're doing what they basically are representing they're doing. When there's a track history, not necessarily with this U.S. attorney, but with the government, where it seems that sometimes that doesn't happen for sure. So we're giving, you know, good faith that they're acting in good faith. And the question then is, how do we proceed? Because they received this petition in April 10th first. It was slightly modified because we added the new bombing accounts in July 30th. But since that time, they've had this evidence to go through with this and to present it. And at what time do we eventually draw the line and say, okay, well, we have to act to try to make sure that they're doing what they said they're doing. So it, as Nick put forth, a two-step process where we do this motion to for disclosure, and then you know, we follow that up with a mandamus if necessary. I think what, at least I would be satisfied, I don't know if Nick would, if they just said, yes, we convened this special grand jury. That, you know, that would satisfy me, or some kind of nod of affirmation that they're moving ahead. We haven't gotten that yet, and as Nick said, that we don't know anyone that's been called, any of the possible witnesses that may be called to substantiate the petition. You know, what that means, I'm not sure. They might have called other people that we don't know about, and certainly that's quite a possibility. So we're left in the limbo, so to speak, and we figured it's time to act, and that's what we're doing. That's what we're proceeding to act in the manner in which Nick laid out for you a few minutes ago.
Now, this is all very interesting. I like it when you guys come on because it gives me an excuse to spend time looking into these questions that, you know, if I have them, everybody else in the truth movement or most people in the truth movement will have them, especially if we're not familiar with the whole grand jury process. So I went a few days ago to the American Bar Association's website, and there's an article posted. It says, Fourth Edition of the Criminal Justice Standards for the Prosecution Function. Under Standard 3-4.5, Relationship with a Grand Jury, this is letter D, it says, the entirety of the proceedings occurring before a grand jury, including the prosecutor's communications with and presentations and instructions to the grand jury, should be recorded in some manner, and that record should be preserved. Prosecutors should avoid off-the-record communications with the grand jury and with individual grand jurors. Now, look, I understand the desire for secrecy in matters like this, because there may be, in other cases, innocent people who are implicated in the subject of a grand jury petition who are ultimately found innocent, and they don't deserve to have their names and reputations tarnished. However, this is a rare and unique matter. This is an issue where there's clear evidence of crime, but the system, for whatever reason, has resisted investigation and prosecution for years. That's why our groups exist right now. So in the end, no matter what the outcome, I want to know, do you have any kind of access to the record of what was done, and how will you know how the presentation to the grand jury went? Like, how do you do a quality control of the presentation of this evidence to them? Do you ever get a chance to know?
Good question. And again, Dave may have insights from his own experience. Let me start with sort of the black and white procedure in the law. First of all, unlike in a regular lawsuit where we would be the plaintiff, and Dave mentioned our FBI lawsuit is against the FBI, which is sort of much more than what I would call normal or routine legal action, where we are a named plaintiff and we will control a lot of the process that happens. And even when we don't control it, it'll be completely visible to us in a civil litigation that's public. But unlike that, the grand jury process is designed not to be overseen by an adversary in the process, you know, one of two adversarial parties, which is how civil litigation works, where the truth is expected to come out from the competing adversaries presenting their respective positions. Unlike that, the grand jury process, which is more investigative in nature, is first intended to be controlled by the grand jury itself, which has broad authority. Second, it's, you know, going to be overseen and given guidance by the U.S. attorney. And third, a federal court has supervisory power. However, all of that process, as I've noted and you've noted, is, even though it's recorded, I mean, as you say, there's a record of whatever's going on. It is being recorded, but it's secret. And it only comes out, if it ever comes out, at the end of the process, which Dave has noted, the end of the process normally is a public decision to indict, or possibly a public decision to not indict, or in this case, possibly a decision to issue a report, an investigative report of potential public misconduct by officials, but not to indict. Now, in the meantime, until one of those outcomes is publicly announced, the law does keep the public in the dark, and there's not a lot we can do to change the way that law is structured or that secrecy until the outcome, with the exception that we have noted, which is to do a petition for a disclosure. And that disclosure could be made in part based on the record that you have noted, Andy, is being created if, in fact, the grand jury is proceeding, because our proceedings would be recorded. So any amount of detail, a lot or a little, could be provided to us by a federal court in a disclosure order because that record is there. Now, it's hard to, in this case, determine what the court will think is the appropriate way to deal with the disclosure. The court could say we're going to make only facts X, Y, and Z available and only to parties A, B, and C, or possibly to their lawyers, and maybe under some sort of protective order or seal order, which means the petitioners, including the lawyers committee, would find out the status, but we also might not be allowed to talk about it until, the outcome. Now, we're sort of in the transparency business, so we're not going to be asking for a secrecy order, but, the court will determine how this proceeds. So I think that's the short answer. There is going to be a record. It is being created. You can petition for a disclosure during the process or after to try to get some of that record unsealed. Dave, do you want to add any thoughts on that?
Right, yes. I've had on a couple of occasions been able to actually make motions to get the grand jury transcripts because I was defending a co-defendant in one case where he basically was being charged with the major crime, which had to do with armed robbery and things of that nature. And the CODI was, there was a no bill, which means he wasn't indicted. And I wanted to get the transcript, and the prosecutor fought real hard not to allow me to have that transcript. But I forget what I argued, certainly, in that I needed it to defend my client. And I was given it, the full transcript of the proceeding of the CODI, the co-defendant, as to why he was not indicted and why my guy was, which was quite revealing. But so you can't do that. This was after the fact. After the indictments came down, I was able to go in and get the transcript of the hearing. And, everything that basically was said, all the questions the grand jurors asked. And that doesn't happen a lot. It's kind of rare. But I was able to do it on a few occasions. Now, this is a much different situation, I think. We don't know. We're not dealing with CODs right now, or that's what the co-defendants are, things of that nature. But the U.S. attorney may be. So I'm not sure exactly how we would proceed, as we both submit, and I believe that probably after it's all said and done, for some good cause, you may be able to establish a foothold to go in and get the record. I don't think it's done often, and I think that it's there's great guard against that for the protection of various people involved. So it's a very good question, Andy. And again, these are situations that most attorneys never face to have this type of situation, and especially this type of crime. This is the most egregious crime probably in the history of our country. So there seem to be government safeguards and maybe, double the safeguards perhaps. So it's in investigating this. It's not the normal situation is investigating a normal crime. It's an abnormal situation, I believe. So to have the U.S. attorney actually say that he's complying with the law, at least I'll speak for myself, I was pleasantly surprised, to say the least, because a lot of indications are they wouldn't even give us that kind of respect to even acknowledge our petition, but they did, which, again, as we've said before, sometimes you have to look at the historical context in which an action is happening, and there may be reasons other than the merit of the petition for which that action may go forward. So, again, it's a good question, I guess that's the best answer we can give you.
Well, no, it's a good one, and I like what you said about how this is a situation most lawyers have never faced. Just as I've always said, this is a situation most nonprofits have ever faced. I think future groups are going to be looking to you guys as the example of how to pursue something like this. And seeing what you did and studying that and moving forward from that. Under the same article at the American Bar Association site, this is under Standard 3-4.5, Relationship with the Grand Jury, Letter B, it says, where the prosecutor is authorized to act as a legal advisor to the grand jury, the prosecutor should appropriately explain the law and may, if permitted by law, express an opinion on the legal significance of the evidence, but should give due deference to the grand jury as an independent legal body. And then it goes on to say in letter C, the prosecutor should not make statements or arguments to a grand jury in an effort to influence grand jury action in a manner that would be impermissible in a trial. So here's my question. Where does that line fall? You know, giving the opinion on legal significance, can you explain that? Is that possible to sway the significance of evidence based on the explanation that it may not be legally significant? Where does the line fall, and is a prosecutor allowed in this case to give his or her opinion to the grand jury on the veracity of the evidence?
Well, let me start, and then again, Dave can add The document you're looking at, I don't have it in front of me, but it sounds like an American Bar Association guidance document, which is sort of a hybrid of, you know, giving recommendations for how to handle both state and federal grand juries. So, and the law is different in different states to some extent, and the state law is different than the federal. So you can't take what the Bar Association is saying there as if it's like black and white law applicable to our situation. But there's nothing really that you quoted there that sounds incorrect to me as a general matter. So there's a history over decades of U.S. attorneys becoming more involved, government attorneys becoming more involved in grand jury proceedings rather than less involved. Historically, the grand jury acted more on its own initiative, without a lot of guidance and certainly without a lot of control by U.S. attorneys. These days, a number of lawyers who have dealt with grand juries have reported that they believe that the U.S. attorney in some grand juries, we're not talking about our case specifically, in the past have asserted quite a bit of control over what the grand jury does. And there's that old saying that a good U.S. attorney can indict a ham sandwich, meaning basically they can get the grand jury to do whatever they want. Now, they're not supposed to do that. And the rules that the ABA is describing and that you're quoting basically say they're not supposed to do that. So can a U.S. attorney, in the secrecy that the rule applies, go beyond the proper role of supporting and guiding the grand jury on the law, maybe assisting them in implementing their investigation, and go further to start giving argument about what they should or shouldn't do to improperly influence them? Yeah, that can happen. It probably has happened. It shouldn't happen, and there's not a lot to prevent it from happening until some light of day is shown on the secret proceedings, because otherwise no one's going to know that it's happening other than the grand jurors themselves. Now, the grand jurors can complain to the federal district court that the U.S. attorney is overstepping their bounds and may be intruding on the grand jury's independence. You would need a fairly assertive grand jury or a foreperson to do that, but that's, you know, something they would have the power to do. So it is a risk. Let me stop there and let Dave chime in, and then before you go to your next question after that, Andy, I wanted to just quote a couple provisions of Rule 6 for you, given your interest in looking at the sort of mechanics of the law. You may find those interesting.
Sure.
as Mick said, something you hear among the defense attorneys is that if the prosecutor wanted to indict a ham sandwich, he could. I mean, he could control the action. And as Mick pointed out earlier on, I don't believe it was to that extent, but he can direct and be the the concert director there. What he would want to do is unroll the story or the facts of the case. And show the grand jurors the various connections. Before there's indictments, he would outline the various crimes we're talking about, and there could be elements of the crime. And, so they would have to be looking through this voluminous material as far as ascertaining, whether, and we're asserting here that there was pre-planted explosives in the buildings and bombs and things of that nature. So those exhibits would represent statements or from the fact, we'd like to say dispositive of that very fact, that there were pre-planted explosives in the building. And they would listen to the statements of the firemen and read the reports of, like, Dr. Rousseau, who talks about there's a seismic readings indicating there was bombs in the basement prior to the plane sitting, and read Niels Harris and Stephen Jones's reports, etc. So they would have a good feeling as to whether these crimes, in fact, were committed. And then they would have to, through their investigations and through testimony, try to focus in on possible suspects. Now, as Mick said, we gave them a list of people of material information, and then we're not saying they're suspects. We're saying that these are people you may want to talk to that have information that's important in resolving the case. So as they move forward, they would have the suspects, and they would have the crimes attached to the suspects. So as I said, the elements of the crimes, they would review that with the grand jurors, and then they would eventually zoom in on certain people they think may be responsible for these crimes. And then the elements of the crime have to do with conspiracy, too. So it's not just bombing, but it's conspiracy or aiding and abetting. So that would be more than just one person. It could be a team of people. Now, the experience I've had with a grand jury, this is a U.S. attorney, though, in the FBI in New Jersey. It took about 2 years to do that investigation. You know, that was like, oh, man, when are they going to ever eventually get, conclusion? Now, the U.S. attorney here, and that was a simpler case. I mean, almost simpler, way simpler. This is really a complicated case, I think. And so they've had that, the full petition in April last year, and then it was amended in July. So they haven't even had it for a year that they're full. And the persons of material information were more recently submitted earlier this year. So it may be argued that, come on, given the length and breadth of this crime, they haven't had enough time to really get in there and do the work that we're expecting them to do. That could be an argument, and possibly could be true based on the activity in the Southern District, because that is a busy court. So that's a little bit what I wanted to add to it, the reference to the elements. The U.S. attorney would, or in my case, my familiarity with the prosecutor, presents that and explains it to the jurors, but they unravel the case. They make the connections. They bring witnesses in that can substantiate the theory. They have to start to develop a theory of their own. I would think the first thing they have to do, though, is to realize that the official theory is not sound, and that there's another theory, and that's the one we put forth, that pre-planted explosives brought those buildings down.
So, Andy, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to quote you a couple provisions from the criminal rules, Rule 6. Is that okay?
Sure.
So this is the current version of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6, and under the subsection E as in Edward, Rule 6E, it says a couple of things of relevance. And if you put these pieces together, I think you'll better understand why we've developed the strategy we have described of first requesting a disclosure and then, as a backup and in the alternative, proceeding with a request for an order under a mandamus petition. So the first provision of interest is Rule 6E1, which says recording the proceedings, and among other things it says, except while the grand jury is deliberating or voting, all proceedings must be recorded by a court reporter or by a suitable recording device. And it also says, unless the court orders otherwise, and I emphasize this phrase, unless the court orders otherwise, an attorney for the government will retain control of the recording, the reporter's notes, and any transcript prepared from those notes. So that's the first provision of relevance. There is a record required to be kept. The government attorney maintains control of it until a court orders otherwise. So then Rule 6E2, and the heading is secrecy, it has several provisions. The ones of most relevance would be subsection capital B, which says, unless these rules provide otherwise, the following persons must not disclose a matter occurring before the grand jury. And there's a list of several categories of people: the grand jurors, interpreters, court reporters, operator of a recording device, a person who transcribes recorded testimony, and most importantly, an attorney for the government. And so that is the rule that the U.S. attorney is currently relying on to not disclose details to us as to the status of our petition. And then there are some exceptions that are provided for, but the one of greatest interest would be 3 capital E, subsection little I, which says the court may authorize disclosure at a time, in a manner, and subject to any other conditions that it directs of a grand jury matter preliminarily to or in connection with a judicial proceeding. And so the court has some authority to make a disclosure, and there may be some other provisions and some case law that come into play here, and we're not prepared to unpack the details of what we may brief on this, but that's sort of the language of the law that we're dealing with. I just wanted you to be aware of that.
Well, in my own research on this, it seemed like requesting a record of what went on happens if somebody believes that something wasn't done properly or there was some impropriety done there, if the lawyer suspects that. I guess what I'm wondering, though, is if you don't have a record available immediately to you that those things happened, how do you cite evidence that it happened to request that record? It seems like a chicken or the egg type of thing to me.
Well, it may be. However, we have anticipated arguments and approaches to solving that chicken and egg problem. And the problem you're describing is, you know, how do you assert in good faith that there's enough either inaction or misconduct to justify disclosure when the secrecy basically prevents you from seeing any of the misconduct or even knowing whether there's inaction, and that is a challenge. But this case, you know, regarding 9/11 and the Trade Center, it has quite a history. And when I say the case, I don't mean just our petition, but the entire controversy. And so I think it would be premature, Dave, for us to disclose our thinking on, you know, the details we may put into our motion for disclosure or mandamus petition, particularly in regard to justifying a disclosure which may require some showing of misconduct. So at the moment, you know, we're sort of hoping for the best and assuming the best of the U.S. attorney, but, and particularly this U.S. attorney, which, as Dave says, is not the U.S. attorney involved in the, you know, 18-year history of the government's handling or mishandling of 9/11. The DOJ generally has been involved. The FBI has been involved. Attorney generals have been involved, and their subordinates and previous U.S. attorneys, but we're not prejudging the current U.S. attorney by the conduct of his predecessors or prior officials in the Justice Department. So this is a little complicated, a little delicate, and it's litigation sensitive at the moment. So that is one question I won't fully unpack for you in the moment. You will see it when we do our filing publicly. But I will just say we do have a plan for that.
And this is, you know, when we put this petition together, we felt very good with the evidence that was there. In fact, we said it was dispositive or conclusive of the crimes that we alleged that was the bombing. If for some reason there is no indictment or a grand jury, I mean, that, you know, we don't know that now. But I want to say that's a crisis in government, but it certainly would compel us or to come up with some sort of actions to address that legally. I'm not sure what that would be. In other words, if we're expecting the government to act in good faith, what happens if we presented really good facts and they don't act in good faith, or they don't call a grand jury? Now, we assume that they are. I assume they are. But what if they don't? And what actions do we do then? Now, Andy, this is one crime scene. The Lawyers Committee has plans to hopefully do grand jury petitions in other crime scenes in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C., and Virginia, and maybe New Jersey. There's possibilities to do new grand juries. So we may run into this again. I mean, and maybe we might be right now blazing a trail. In other words, this is seldom done at this level. So this may be a test case to see what we can accomplish and what we can take from this and use in other crime scenes. But the significance here is that this evidence was gathered by the architects and engineers, and we put it together, but they had done the yeoman's work to collect it over the last 10 years. In the other crime scenes, it's not going to be as easy. So it's like a test case. And because it's a new proceeding, we're proceeding with some prudence. And as Mick laid out a plan, which we're not giving the details of, for probably a couple of reasons, but we will go forward and try to pursue the justice that is represented by, hopefully, independent people reviewing the evidence.
So, Andy, can I add a couple of thoughts in response to Dave's observations?
Sure.
Dave made a couple points there that probably deserve some elaboration, because your audience may not understand all the ins and outs of this. You may have a better feel for the limits of the grand jury given your research. But, I mean, keep in mind, the grand jury's function is to investigate and indict. And they have not only a lot of authority in doing that, they have a lot of discretion in doing that. So unlike, you know, a government official who does something that's clearly arbitrary and capricious, which would allow citizens to sue them under the Administrative Procedures Act, for example, which is what we're doing in our suit against the FBI, there is no real provision for suing a grand jury if you're unhappy with the quality or outcome of the grand jury's work. You know, you can't bring a suit in federal court and say we don't like the reasoning of the grand jury or the conclusion of the grand jury or how they chose to investigate. That's not going to be a future lawsuit, because, you know, the law provides the grand jury a lot of discretion, even if they screw up the task, and certainly hope they don't, and it's a monumental task that they have in front of them. But even if they were to not do it properly, you know, we're not going to be suing the grand jurors or the grand jury as an entity for poor performance. So, the goal of this petition and of a mandamus action or a disclosure motion, as we've discussed, you know, is to give the grand jury a chance, give the grand jury the opportunity to look at this evidence and to do the right thing. That's the purpose of this entire action. And we have confidence that, you know, 16 to 23 members of our peers, you know, normal citizens who would look at this evidence, we have confidence that they would reach the conclusion that Dave has pointed out that the Lawyers Committee has reached, and I suspect that the architects and engineers have reached as well, which is this evidence is, in fact, dispositive. It's not equivocal. It's very persuasive, to the point that there is really no other explanation other than use of explosives and incendiaries to bring these three buildings down on 9/11. So the question then arises, and Dave posed it, you know, let's say we achieve the goal of this particular action, the petition to the grand jury. Let's say the U.S. attorney is, in fact, as his letter would indicate, proceeding according to the law, presenting the evidence to the grand jury, and let's say the grand jury finishes an investigation and chooses not to indict. where, you know, where does that leave us, in particular, us, the Lawyers Committee, as a nonprofit with this mission of accountability and transparency on 9/11? And, you know, others could ask the same question of themselves. Where does it leave architects and engineers? Where does it leave the family members and other groups that are concerned? And the law does provide other options. It just isn't an option directly related to suing the grand jury. Now, one of those options that the law provides, we are already proceeding on, and that is the lawsuit against the FBI in federal court in Washington, D.C. Some of your folks know about that, some may not. But we have the Lawyers Committee and others, including architects and engineers and Bob McElvain and Barbara Rastelli, are suing the FBI and the DOJ for not complying with another mandate from Congress, which was related to the 2015 9/11 Review Commission. Now, that is actually related to what we're discussing here, Andy, because that type of lawsuit, even though we've already commenced it, is one of the options that remains for us if the grand jury doesn't proceed to an indictment. And the reason there is sort of overlap there is that what we're suing the FBI and the DOJ regarding is their failure to develop and report evidence publicly and to Congress as required by a congressional mandate. A lot of folks don't know that in 2013-2014, the Congress mandated the FBI and the DOJ to assess and report any and all evidence regarding 9/11 that was not considered by the original 2004 9/11 Commission. And in our investigation, we have discovered, which is somewhat obvious on the public record, that the 9/11 Review Commission ignored and omitted several very significant categories, entire categories of evidence regarding 9/11 in their 2015 report to Congress, and that included all the demolition evidence, among others. So, you know, there are paths, legal paths, that can be pursued even if the grand jury chooses not to indict. So, you know, and we haven't disclosed all of the options that we have, but one of them is a matter of public record already, and that is this FBI lawsuit. So we're not entirely without recourse in the matter.
Right, and I just want to reiterate for the audience, we are not presupposing any outcomes. We are not presupposing what's going on behind the scenes with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Right now, the situation stands that the goal of this mandamus action filing, if they do it, will be to have the court confirm that the U.S. Attorney's has acted in good faith and presented the Lawyers Committee's petition, the amended petition, and petition supplements with accompanying evidence to the federal special grand jury, or to confirm that it has not occurred, as the article that we sent out earlier this week says. So I know a lot of people in the movement are closely following this. I know more of us wish we could do more, but a lot of it is in your hands right now, and it's in good hands, in my opinion. And we're going to keep an eye out, and I'm sure if there's new developments in this grand jury filing, AE 9/11 Truth, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, will be letting all our supporters know about it, and I'm sure you'll be back on to talk about it. And unlike courthouse news, my reports will not disappear in an hour after it's posted.
Andy, your listeners can help us if they have evidence or information, they can forward it to us, certainly, at lc4911.org, but we always need donations to keep on going. We'd like to increase our staff. We'd like to do more, and in order to do that, we need to get the financing. We need funding. So if people think that out there that think that this is worthwhile, this is worthy of a contribution, you can make that contribution to lc4911.org, and we'll make good use of your donation. It's a tax-deductible donation. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you guys for doing what you're doing. Ever upward. Good luck. And I know, again, we'll be looking at this very closely, all of us here in the 9/11 Truth Movement. Thank you for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Thank you, Andy.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. So you have a great week. Good luck.